Welcome to the XCGS Cart by Cart podcast, the first and only podcast covering Atari's last answer, the 8-bit gaming system. In episode 20, we jump forward to the year 3097 to compete in the fastest and most competitive game in the universe, Ball Blazer. Then we jump back in time to when pinball was king to play a bit of David's Midnight Magic. Now here are your hosts, David and Michael.
Hi everybody, welcome back again to another show. I guess we'll just go into the news real quick. I had picked up a TRS-80 Model 4 from a guy locally. I actually have a Model 3, which I repaired up a bunch of the... For those who know about the film caps, they know they explode. Mine did that immediately. So I replaced that plus the all the capacitors and the power supply. But this sweet Model 4 came up with a high-res card. I just couldn't pass on it, so I bought that. But as far as that retro stuff goes, that's about all it is with me. What about you, David?
Well, for me, just to let the listeners know, as we're recording this, it's the last day of Portland Retro Gaming Expo, and on the scene is Captain Bob, and he's picked up for me a couple of homebrew games for my Atari 2600, that being Turbo and Elevator Agent, which is a port of Elevator Action, I believe.
Oh, that's a fun game.
Yeah, and Champ Games really makes excellent games. Other than that, I also picked up a Concerto cart for my Atari 7800. And for some reason, I don't know why, I'm thinking about getting the 64 Maxi version, which is basically, it's an emulator, but it's housed within an original-looking C64 bread bin. And do I need it? Absolutely not, because I have an Ultimate 64, which is basically a 64 that is done completely by FPGA. And so really, it would be a downgrade, but somehow that bread bin box is speaking to me. So anyway, that's more money wasted, which I'm very good at.
Well,
and that's about it for now. And I don't want to say anything more, because otherwise my wife will find out how much money I spent on this stuff.
Yes, I think we all have that problem.
Yes. This is why it's a good thing for the wife not to be home when the mailman shows up.
Yeah, you got to have one of those like a P.O. box or something.
Yeah. I know. The first thing, the mailman comes with a package, and the first thing my dog Gigi has to bark to wake everybody up.
Yeah.
I mean, we're already awake, but if we're not awake, we're going to be awake. So, of course, then everybody gets alerted, and then I have to open the front door, and there's a guy there who wants my signature. And I got a sign, and I get this box, and depending on how big the box is, it can be very problematic. And then it's like, oh, another toy. No, this is from a friend.
Yeah, yeah.
A friend sent me this.
Just gave it to me. Yeah.
Yeah. I just had to pay shipping. His name is some guy from China. But anyway. The life of a collector, right?
Yes, very true, very true. Yeah, I've been slimming down mine because I, the garage is only so big. So,
yeah,
only the best deals possible do I buy that. But
yeah, I've gotten to that point now where it's almost like I'm trying to say, okay, if I visually do not have a place to put it that I can access it easily and see it,
yes,
on a regular basis, then I don't need it.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. Unless
you're talking to the guy who has four Atari 5200s.
Yeah. Well, those are backups.
Three of them are in the basement.
Just in case, if one goes bad, you got a spare.
Yeah,
that's why I have four.
Of course, that's why I have four Atari 2600s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got to have the backup.
They're old.
You're not a hoarder at all.
No.
Hello and good morning, sports fans. I'm Slan Sterling, voice of the void, coming to you live today from a null gravity nexus midspace in the binary star system Kalaxan and Calabar. Now, moments from now, on the luminous surface of this artificial asteroid, we're going to be witnessing what promises to be some incredible action in this Ball Blazer Championship.
Well, I guess we'll do our first game. Name is Ball Blazer. It is published by Atari Corporation. It was actually first published by Epix in 1985. and also Activision UK in 1985. It was published for the XCGS in 1987. Its model number is RX8064. The genre is sports miscellaneous. And let's talk about the developers. So first off, looking through the manual, it appears Lucasfilm really likes to give credit in their game manuals for the people that work on their games, because this is probably the most impressive amount of information about the people that worked on this game that I've ever seen in a manual. So we'll start off with the project leader, who was David Levine, and he was responsible for creating the concept, designing and implementing the screen graphics, physical dynamics, control structures, and mainline program. These are all things I've never even heard of. The game's group leader was Peter Langson. He designed and implemented the sound effects, created the practice droid intelligence, composed and programmed the music, and helped devise the gameplay mechanism and strategies. Then there was also David Roydan and Gary Hare, and they worked for Search and Design, or it says of Search and Design. I assume that's another company. They contributed game design elements and game rules. And there was Charlie Kellner. He helped conceptualize the game dynamics. Also David Fox, who provided aesthetic support. And Gary Whitnick, who contributed to the rotofoil design and the introductory animation. So your rotofoil is your pod in the game. Number of players is one versus two, and a demo mode. And the controller is the joystick. Let's talk about the back of the box. The year is 3097, and you are a contestant in the fastest, most competitive, and by far the most popular sport in the universe. You and your opponent are strapped into rotofoils, hovercraft-like vehicles that skim the surface on the playfield at speeds of up to 50 meters a second. Your objective is simple: score the most points during the timed competition and be declared the champion. Your task, however, is a bit more complex. At the speed you're traveling, firing a plasma word through the opponent's goal takes more than just skill and timing. Do you want to take an over-the-horizon shot worth 3 points, or get within sight of the goal for a two-point attempt? Your safest bet is to push it through, but this takes up more precious time and is only worth 1 point. Think fast, because this is a two-player game and your opponent is making the same decisions. Or is he? Ball Blazer features two players simultaneous play with first-person perspective for both players. Three playing modes are available: regulation game, practice mode, or spectator mode.
Now, before we talk about playing the game, I just wanted to say that I think my forte is the 1 point the 1 point option in this game. I mean, I basically grabbed that plasma orb and I run like crazy trying to find those gold beams. Okay, so let's get back to playing the game. The screen starts off with a large Lucasfilm font bending over the word games. Immediately, a plasma orb goes whizzing by, followed by a rotofoil. Back and forth they go when all of a sudden the gold beams appear. Eventually, the rotofoil stops, lowers its windscreen, and reveals a pilot who waves at you. This is all done in graphics mode 9, which produces 16 different luminescence of the same hue, with the pilot being done in PM graphics. Lucasfilm also used this graphics mode for your mothership in Rescue on Fractalis. It looks amazing. After about 30 seconds, the screen changes to show both rotofoils, one over the other, showing each other's reflection in the other's windshields, implying that they are facing one another. If you're patient and just want to get to the game, press the start button and it will take you to the game screen. Speaking of that, the game screen shows the views of the grid or a checkerboard playfield from a first-person perspective, sitting in the rotofoil's cockpit in a horizontal split-screen format. Separating these view cycles, the words Ball Blazer, then the producer with the copyright date, and finally, Tournament Certified Interstellar Ball Blazer Conference. We noticed while writing this review that when the screen went into the screen-saving a track mode, the two play fields disappeared, and all that was left on the screen was the title Ball Blazer. Now, when we talk about game settings, pressing the option key cycles between game time and the two players, purple and orange. Whatever option is selected will flash. With the game time selected, press the select button to choose how long you want the game to last. You can choose between 1 to 9 minutes. The initial time is 3 minutes. By default, the game is set between two human players. If you'd like to play one player versus computer, press the option key and select whatever color you want the computer to play as. Pressing the select key will change the human player to 9 different droids. 1 is the easiest, 9 is the most difficult. If you select 2 droids, you become a spectator of the game and watch the machines battle it out. For fun, we wanted to see how long it would take for a level 1 droid to lose to a level 9 droid. It was about 1 minute and 13 seconds. After you have made your choice in the settings, press the start button to start the game. If you need to pause the game at any time, just press the select key.
Okay, let's talk about controls. Well, your joystick allows you to choose the direction in which you guide your rotofoil. The rotofoil is equipped with the RotoSnap computer that automatically rotates or rotosnaps your rotofoil 90 degrees to face the plasmorb. If the player has possession of the plasmorb, then the rotofoil is automatically pointed towards the opponent's goal beams. Your rotofoil is surrounded by a force field which serves a few purposes. While traveling without the plasmorb, the force field becomes a bump field that withstands collisions with other objects. When the rotofoil is within a few meters of the plasmorb, the force field becomes a pull field which automatically captures the ball and centers it towards the goal. If the player is in possession of the plasmorb, pressing the fire button turns the force field into a push field which launches the ball. You can steal the plasmorb from your opponent by rushing up beside your opponent and pressing the fire button, which, if you're lucky, will push the plasmorb away and out of the opponent's possession. This is where you would then try to rush towards the plasmorb so you can take possession of it.
So let's talk a little bit more about gameplay. So let's talk about the grid. It consists of 1,155 squares surrounded by an electro boundary, which keeps the players and the ball contained within. At each end of the grid, there are goal beams, which move back and forth across the end at 5 meters per second. As players' scores increases, the distance between the goal beams decreases, making it harder to score for that player. We'll talk more about how the score works a bit later. Players start at the opposite ends of the grid. When the timer starts, so does the game. Push your joystick forward, left, right, to try to find and get possession of the plasmorb and try to score. If your opponent gets possession of the plasmorb first, try to dislodge it from your opponent and get possession of it and, of course, score. Scoring is a bit different than most sports games you've encountered. There are a total of 10 score circles. Each side gets 5. As a side scores, their 5 circles get populated. But if a team gets more than 5 points, their opponent's circles get filled. A winner is determined as to who has the most score circles when the time runs out, or whoever gets all 10 circles filled first. Shooting the plasmorb while the goal beams are over the horizon gets you 3 points. This is called an over-the-horizon or OTH shot. Doing the same while the goal beams are in view gains you 2 points. And shooting the plasmorb through the goal beams while they are close gains you 1 point. When the game ends, a victory horn is sounded while the losing player's rotofoil spins off across the grid.
Okay, some history and trivia. The game was called Ball Blaster during development, and some pirated versions bear that name. Now, one of the most interesting things about this game is the theme music titled Song of the Grid. It was an algorithmically generated technique called riffology and designed by Lucasfilm's game team leader, Peter Langston, who was an experienced jazz, rock, and folk musician. The lead melody is assembled from a predefined set of 32 8-note melody fragments or riffs, which are put together randomly by an algorithm that also makes choices on several parameters, including how fast to play the riff, how loud to play it, when to omit or elide notes, or when to insert a rhythmic break. The melody is accompanied by a bass line, drums, and chords, which are also assembled on the fly by a simplified version of the above approach. In effect, the music plays forever without repeating itself, but without straying too far from the original theme. We found two YouTube videos that give a more visual example of this, which we will provide in the show notes. If you type author during the title sequence while the credits fade in and out, you will see the programmer credits and the creator's name and roles will be displayed. As we're reading through the game's documentation, we notice several words that were trademarked by Lucasfilm LTD. These are as follows: the R booster, ball blazer, well, that's obvious, bump field, droid, I think we got that from, that was copyrighted back in Star Wars, electro boundary, ethercast, goal beams, interstellar ball blazer championship, calamar, calazon, kipling, master blazer, over the horizon shot, plasma orb, pole field, rotofoil, rotosnap, song of the grid, and all other character names and elements of the game fantasy. In the manual, they give special thanks to George Lucas. That makes sense. As previously mentioned, the rotofoils travel up to 50 meters per second. That's about 180 kilometers per hour, or converted, that's 162.042 feet per second, or 111.84 miles per hour. So pretty darn fast.
So now we come to talk about the legacy of this game. Now, usually we just tell you what other systems that this was ported to in this section, but we thought it's worth discussing the turbulent release process this game went through. Initially, the game was planned to be released on both Atari 8-bit and 5200. The games were ready by March 1984 and were first publicly revealed at a Lucasfilm press conference on May 8, 1984. The 5200 cartridge version was planned to be released in the third quarter of 1984, with disc versions for the C64, IBM PC, and Apple IIc released under the Atari Soft label in the fourth quarter. On May 21st, 1984, Atari also announced it would be released for their upcoming Atari 7800 console. Then, on July 3rd of 1984, Warner Communications sold all assets of the consumer division of Atari Inc. to Jack Tramiel, and the agreement with Lucasfilm fell through. Between January 5th to 8th in 1985, at the Winter Consumer Electronics Show, it was announced that Epix would become the distributor for the game, which would be released on disc form for the Atari computer line and the C64, but the 5200 version was not part of that deal. Tramiel's Atari finally released the game in limited quantities to the 5200 in 1986 from the manufactured stock inherited from the buyout. Since the 5200 was discontinued in May 1984, this is sort of comical. Now, I got my copy from an eBay seller in Venezuela a few years ago. There was like a huge stash of Atari stuff that was being sold out of Venezuela.
I remember that. It was awesome. Yeah.
And that's where I picked up Ball Blazer for the Atari 5200. And that's where I picked up Rescue on Fractalis.
Nice.
Yeah. Finally, by August 1985, the games made it to the market legally. The XCGS version was released in December 1987 and the 7800 version in 1988. So here's the complete list of the machines it was eventually released for: Atari 5200, Atari 7800, Commodore 64 by Epix, Apple II by K-Byte, Famicom by Pony Canyon, the Amstrad CPC, MSX, ZX Spectrum by Activision. So now let's talk about my review. So for graphics, I gave this game an 8. From the Lucasfilm's opening to seeing all the elements of gameplay, the gold beams, Plasmorb, and the roto foils flying by, to the canopy opening up and the pilot waving to the player, to the visual of the reflection of each other's opponent in the windshields. It's a great game opener. Yes, the objects may not be all that complex, and the play field is a checkerboard, but the graphics move very fluid and fast. You literally feel that you're sliding around on a hovercraft-type experience. Plus, you get a split-screen, first-person view that I don't think was all that common in those days. Sound and music, I'm giving it a 10. Music is where this game excels. The Pokéchip shines. From the catchy tune, which includes many musical notes, the almost shoe-tapping sound you hear as you move around the play field are seamlessly punctuated by the game sound effects. The whooshes as things pass by, the sound of your shot, to the triumphant score sound effect. It's what I think is the most impressive feature of this game. Now, gameplay, I gave it two different scores, 7 for single player and 9 for two player. This game is simple and fast, but has scoring mechanics to support risky shots over safe one-pointers. Opponents can steal points and games are fast and furious. Of course, the game will always be more fun with a friend, but it's still a very satisfying one-player experience. Presentation. Yes, it's your regular XCGS box that we've all come to know, but you have a really nice, almost photorealistic image of the rotofoils, game grid, and the Plasmorb hurtling right at you with a sense of speed. The back of the box tells you everything you need to know with two screenshots. The game manual is pretty standard monocolor, but it's well written. So my overall score for this game, single player, is 8 out of 10 and 8.5 for two players. But since this is such a great game, I'm going to bump up that score for two players to 9 out of 10.
Nice. Well, I love
it. Now for the real review.
Well, I love this game back in the day, and I even played this game with my oldest daughter, who loves it as well. As far as graphics go, I'm going to give it a 10. First off, zooming over the grid really gives you a sense of speed. Now, I know that we saw this previously in the Snaps game Dimension X, but I think this actually looks slightly better, and of course it has that split screen. The fonts for choosing the game you want to play or the time clock are just so unique. You don't generally get to see, that creative of a font. They use a great use of the color cycling. The pods look really cool. I mean, if you saw this being played as store back, then you know those graphics would have just drew you in. Sound of music, again, I give it a 10. Some of the best music that came out for the Atari computer, and the fact that it's algorithmically generated, I mean, wow, that's amazing. There's also that electrical hum when you come in contact with your opponent that fades in and out based on the proximity to one another. So that's so cool. I love the goal alert and that it breaks into the song of the grid music when you score. This is a game that shows how well good sound and music can really boost a game. Gameplay, I get about a 9. While I think the sports games are more fun when playing with friends, the one-player game is also pretty challenging. I mean, you have 1 through 9 different AIs. So, start out with 1 and work your way up. I also like that the goal beams get closer together and more challenging to score on the closer the player gets to winning the game. Now, I don't expect much variety in gameplay from sports games. I think there could have been an opportunity to maybe add power-ups, but that's pretty much the only thing I could suggest to make this game even better. Presentation, I give it an 8. Let's face it. As David said, compared to the Epic's game manual, the XCGS manual is pretty much pathetic. But it does give you a bit of background of this imaginary sport and does provide some strategy tips. But aside from the cover image, you get one screenshot while the Epic's manual explodes with color and visual information. Where the game gets its presentation points is in the cool intro, which was pretty spectacular back in the day, and in my opinion, still holds up. So overall score, I give it a 9. Ball Blazer is one of my go-to two-player games, and provides plenty of fun. Although I don't think it would keep today's kids occupied for too long, seeing they have similar games like Rocket League, it does provide a thrilling challenge for those who enjoy their futuristic sports on a more 2D plane. This is definitely a game you should have in your collection.
So now let's go on to our second game we're reviewing, and the name of this game is David's Midnight Magic, not to be confused with this David, who never wrote anything of noteworthiness.
Did you have Midnight Magic ever?
No. The publisher was the XCGS Atari Corp, and back in 1982 was Broderbund. The year that this was released for the XCGS was 1987. The model number is RX8083. The genre is pinball, standard table. The developer was David Snyder. And the number of players is 1, 2 alternating, and up to 4. Now, the controllers you use is just a joystick. Now, let's take a look at the back of the box. This is it, the best of both worlds. Real pinball and video arcade action in one famous game. Get ready for real-life pinball on your TV. Keep your eyes on the screen and launch the ball. Smash the ball across the game board using the double flipper. Bounce off the bumper and hit actual drop targets. Zero in on the colored targets for even higher scores. And then head on over to the rollovers to score even more bonus points. You can shake the machine to get that extra body English into your play. But look out, too much action and the game reads tilt and your score is penalized. It is hot pinball action at its best, with extra point advantages at every turn. Up to 3 balls can be at play at the same time, and if you're good enough, you can really rack up the points. David's Midnight Magic delivers all the action, sounds, and thrills of real arcade pinball. Up to 4 players can compete, and you don't have to worry about running out of quarters. Now let's talk about playing the game. The title screen specifically. When you power the game on, you are shown the pinball playfield on the right. Within the playfield flashes copyright 1987 Atari. On the left is the game title, the original publisher, Broderbund, as well up to 4 scores and some bonus and message indicators, all cycling to resemble a pinball game not in play. Press start or the joystick button. Then press the option button to select players 1 through 4. Press start or the joystick button to position the ball on the launcher. So when we talk about levels, the game offers no options to increase or decrease the difficulty. The controls. To launch the ball, pull the joystick towards you and put tension on the launcher. Press the fire button to release the ball. While the ball is in play, moving the joystick forward or backward will activate both flippers at once. Moving the joystick forward also gives you the nudge effect, or you can move the joystick left or right to move them individually. If you work the flippers too hard, the machine will tilt. When this happens, the point multipliers are deactivated and your ball is lost. At any time, you can press the select to pause the game and press it again to resume.
All right, let's cover some of the playfield elements. I'm guessing most of you listening have played a game or two of pinball, but you might not know all of the functional areas of the game. So let's just lightly discuss these things, starting with the upper left of the playfield. A more visual description is available within the XEGS manual. But there's the upper level loop with targets. This path will take your ball into an elevated area on top of the playfield. This section contains the following elements. A ball collector. When your ball goes in here, it gets saved for when the multi-ball is triggered. You got the Fuji bumper, the drop targets, the rollover, and your 2 flippers. In the bottom level of the table, this area consists of the rest of the playfield and contains the following elements. Lower level loop, which is located just to the right of the upper level loop. The drop targets, these appear in 3 spots on the lower level. The multi-ball release, this looks like a little hole just under the top left flipper. Target, located to the left of the multi-ball release. Magic save, left and right. These will appear as square brackets when activated, and arrows will point at them. Ball release square, left and right. This is a small square that will appear within the drain area. Rollover, this is only on the right. Kickers, and again, two more flippers. Okay, gameplay. The object of the game is to keep the ball in play and hit as many targets as possible, so it's pinball. Each player gets 5 balls per game. In the multiplayer game, each player gets 1 ball per turn until each player has used all of their balls. Players can earn an extra ball each time they drop a ball into the ball collector. Hitting the multi-ball releases any previously captured balls for play. This means that now you have to juggle up to 3 balls in play.
So when we talk about scoring, let's first talk about the drop targets. All 5 top level left drop targets are worth 5,000 points and also 5 bonus points. All 3 top level right drop targets are 3,000 points and 3 bonus points. All 4 bottom right drop targets are 2,000 points, 2 bonus points, and 1 use of the left magic save magnet. Other drop targets are worth between 400 to 440 points each. Each bottom level target is worth 250 points. Each top level loop target is worth 1,000 points. The Fuji bumper is worth 500 points. Now, dropping the ball in the ball collector is 10,000 points. You can also get 10 bonus points and an extra ball. Dropping 3 balls into the ball collector releases all of the balls.
It all balls.
Kicking a ball into the lower level loop, 5,000 points and a point multiplier increase by 1. When the point multiplier is at 5 or above, kicking the ball into the loop scores 5,000 points and an extra ball. Multi-ball release, 5,000 points, 5 bonus points, and releases all the balls in the ball collector. Rollovers are 1,000 points and 1 bonus point. Kickers are 300 points and moves the rollover to the next column. Now, the manual does have some notes on strategy. The manual suggests these things in obtaining your best score. Send the ball through the upper or lower loops to increase the points multiplier. Hit all the top right or left drop targets or all bottom right or left drop targets to get bonus points and reset them. To help you avoid losing a ball down the side gutter, hit the lower left or right targets to activate the magic save magnets. Try to drop as many balls as possible into the ball collector. If you later hit the multi-ball release, these balls will be available for play.
All right, history and trivia. Well, David's Midnight Magic is closely modeled after the popular real-life System 7 pinball table, Black Knight, released by Williams in 1980. Black Knight is also a two-level play field game, a first for a pinball game, and something that would be difficult to replicate on an 80s computer. This was the first of a series of 4 games that featured 2 levels and a version of MagnaSave. There was Jungle Lord, Pharaoh, Solar Fire, and Grand Lizard. MagnaSave allowed you to press a second button on either side of the cabinet as a primary method of saving balls when draining. The playfields were full of flashing indicators, something a video version lacks significantly. This pinball machine also says 5 phrases such as, "You cannot fight and win," "The Black Knight will slay you," and "I challenge thee to fight me." David's Midnight Magic won Computer Game of the Year at the 4th Avenue Archie Awards, where judges described it as a program that is both an exciting video game and a fairly faithful evocation of pinball mystique. The disc version of David's Midnight Magic offers slight differences from the cartridge version. It allows you to save your scores by notching the disc to make it writable, a kind of dangerous feature since one could accidentally overwrite the game disc itself and, as the manual states, void your warranty. Why not allow high scores to save to a different disc, Broderbund? The disc version also uses paddles, I guess, because side buttons feel more realistic than a joystick. To activate MagnaSave, you hit a specific set of keys on the left, which would be Z, X, C, or V. To trigger the left MagnaSave or the keys M, period, or forward slash to activate it on the right. Of course, the XEGS version happens automatically because some of the players might not have purchased an XEGS with a keyboard. But I would have liked to have the option to use those keys if I wanted to.
Let's talk about the legacy of this game. It was ported to the Apple II in 1982, the Atari 2600 in 1986. That was titled Midnight Magic, and it played much differently. For the Atari 8-bit computer in 1982, the Commodore 64 in 1983, the PC 8801 series, 1984, published by SystemSoft. And in 2005, a visual pinball recreation of David's Midnight Magic was created called David's Midnight Magic 2005, which is rendered with modern 3D graphics.
Okay, time for my review. So in the arcades, pinball was getting a revival. I have fond memories of pinball games such as Funhouse and Cyclone. Unfortunately, no system at the time could really represent pinball, the pinball experience. Still, we would take what we could get, and what we got wasn't too bad, but still had some way to go. For graphics, I give it a 6. It's just another direct port from the Apple II, and while certain games like Choplifter and Load Runner retain a certain charm, you can't really ignore that the developer didn't decide to take advantage of the Atari's superior graphics capabilities. Elements are identifiable, but don't really impress the senses of a pinball player of that time. For sound and music, I also give it a 6. It's not much more than what the Apple outputted. Still, it's more than bleeps and bloops that we're used to from those Apple games. Gameplay, I give it a 7. I love that you have 4 flippers to control. I do feel, however, that the gravity of the ball is a bit too heavy, and it would have been a nice touch to be able to adjust that within the game. Still, the flippers perform perfectly, but I don't like how the ball is designed to sink if you don't engage the flippers. I fired them up, and it drained immediately, so you got to be on top of that. Still, the game of pinball has always required a bit of skill, and in this case, it isn't affected by magnets, so I'll accept this slight oversight. Presentation, I give it a 5. Demo screen just shows all the messages that could light up, which is much like a real pinball game, but there is no demo, so there isn't much to draw a new player in. The XEGS manual is all of 4 pages, but in this case, this is actually more pages than the original disc version. So I actually think this version's manual is better than the original. I don't know, color me surprised. Overall score, I give it a 6. I looked over all the pinball games made for the Atari computer, and they all sort of looked and played like this game, but with the addition of the 4 flippers made this one stand out. Still, if you have a disk drive, there is a game called Pinball Construction Set, which will allow you to play a similar style tables as well as create your own. But if you don't, this is your only option. Would I recommend it? Yes. It's fun, but it doesn't really offer the thrill of playing on a real pinball table. I don't think we captured that until Full Tilt Pinball for the PC was released. And for the most of us, we all played Space Cadet on Windows. And that was, when it was released for the masses, and that was a very enjoyable game. But if you want your XEGS pinball fix, I don't think this is a bad purchase.
Okay, so now we'll go to my review. For graphics, I gave it a 5. Well, it is a port from the Apple II. Definitely, I felt it needed more game elements on the play field. More colors would have been nice. Green and pink may have not been the most complimentary colors to use. For sound and music, the sound is minimal. There's no music. I give it a 5. Gameplay, in this instance, I give it a 6. I feel the game suffers from the squat nature of the playfield. the ball moves very fast, and on a small play field, I just didn't feel I had enough time to react. Good use of the joystick. However, this game could have really benefited from the use of Atari paddles, with each paddle controlling one side versus toggling back and forth, up and down on a single joystick. Presentation, I'm going to give it a 6. It's interesting that the cover shows the use of two paddles to play this game. A little false advert here. Again, standard XEGS box format. The color is nice, has illustration work, and is faithful to the actual game field. The back boasts real pinball and video game action all in one game. Now, my overall score. Now, if I was reviewing this game back in 1982, my expectations would have been a lot less, and I would have been more impressed. Heck, I had tons of fun with my Parker Brothers Wildfire handheld electric pinball machine. So compared to that, this is a major upgrade. It's a good game, but it should have been more by the time we got to 1987. So my overall score is 5.5. It is a good pinball game. It is worth owning, especially if you're a collector of XEGS cartridges. So there's only so many. So I would definitely pick this up if you get it for a good price. Now, how long it's going to hold your attention, mileage will differ, but it is still a good, decent pinball game.
You said the Wildfire pinball game. Is that the little one with the little LEDs?
Yeah.
For the ball? I had that as well.
Yeah, it was, and you fun. Had like a... I love that thing.
Yeah. Boy, we had...
And I felt, to be honest to you, it's very similar play field.
Yeah.
And I had more fun with that than this game.
That's
funny. I
don't
know what. Maybe the ball physics in that handheld maybe worked a little better. You know what I find with this game? I find that I think the ball moves a little bit too fast for me.
Yep.
And also, you remarked about the heaviness.
Yes.
I feel like when I would hit it with the paddle, it's like, okay, how do I have to hit this ball exactly to be able to get it to go further? Like, I just felt that, you know, like how you said, there was a heaviness to it. So when you hit the ball, it was like just really hard.
Yeah, the ball felt heavier than what a normal pinball, just slightly, but just it wasn't. The one thing I did, though, I like about it, a lot of pinball games do this, is when you hold it, you know, you flip the flipper up and it sits in the little pivot point.
Yeah.
Some of the other pinball games I've played kind of dances around in that area. This sat perfectly. So that, you know, aside from, you know, like I said, the playing of the thing, I think it was really, the physics were almost there.
Yeah.
Just a little too heavy for me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I remember playing pinball myself as a kid, and I would love it when the ball would get stuck up at the top, boom, 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 and you get a break for a while. You can take a breather and rack up the points.
Yeah.
And I just felt because, well, let's put it to you this way. It's not a regulation rectangle play field.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's kind of squat.
Yeah, yeah.
And because of that, there's only so far, you know, the ball has to go. And I think maybe they try to compensate that by making the ball heavier.
Yeah,
so
maybe.
It wasn't that easy that you could always get the ball at the top.
Yeah.
Like I did have one time I was able to get like two balls in play.
Yeah.
And that was pretty fun.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. Well, if you've ever played the pinball, the video game / pinball Baby Pac-Man, I remember that, you know, it was a great concept, but the ball sunk so quick. It was a struggle just to keep it on the table. So this wasn't this much problem, but it reminded me of it.
Yeah. But you know, what can you do? Sometimes our reviews are a little tainted because we're talking like 30 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you different eyeballs.
Yeah. But for sure, like 100%, because I love the Wildfire electronic game. I know that if I had this back at the time it came out, I'm not talking about 1987 when it came out for the XEGS. I'm talking about 1982.
Yeah.
I know that it would have been great.
Yeah. I mean, unless you had to go to the arcade to play it, this is all you got. Yeah. So.
But it is a shame, though, that Atari didn't take advantage of the, like, that 5 years had passed.
Yeah.
and a little bit jazz it up.
Yeah, they just did direct ports. And, you know, like I said, they're essentially, if you look at the Apple and you look at this, it's you know, they didn't do anything special, which is really a shame. Any game that they do that, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love the Apple, but it doesn't hold a candle to the Atari's graphic capabilities. And I feel like you could have just went the little extra mile. But I think they just wanted to get out the door as fast as possible, make a buck. So our next episode will be a very important milestone for us. We will have reviewed every officially released game for the XE gaming system. We started this podcast back in 2015, and we've gone through a few changes over the years, but it's amazing to think that we finally reached the end of this long road. Aside from our last review, we'd love to hear from those who have listened, and we welcome any questions you might have for us or our experiences with the show so we can read them on the air. You can either email those questions to feedback@xegs8bit.com or respond to the post on Facebook or Twitter where we announce our last officially released game review. Until next time, keep gaming! In our next episode, we soar over the sands of Egypt, defending ourselves against mythical beasts while we collect ancient treasures in our desert falcon. Then we find ourselves having reviewed every release game for the XEGS, and we'll feature your questions and comments on the show.
You can find our latest episodes, news, and information on our website, www.xegs8bit.com. We also have links on there so you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We'd like to thank ComputeHer for giving us permission to use her song Software as our show's theme song. You can visit ComputeHer at ComputeHer.com. That's ComputeHer.com for more information. Also, thanks to the folks who contribute to and maintain the Atari Mania database, Wikipedia, and other fine results of Google search engines.
And I would have been more impressed. Heck, I had funds of ton. Oh, look at that. I put the beam goals when it should be goal beams.
Yes.
These are
they're trademarked.
Yeah.
Right.
So, Luke is looking after us.